Yesterday, I spent some time in the Tuileries with some American friends who were visiting from New York. A couple and their son, and the couple are both actors. And one of them was here working on, was acting in a film here, and was filming. And they told me that they had learned there was a system in France where for actors, if they weren't working, they were still given money from the government to work, to help them live. And the woman, in the couple, she looked at me and she said, "It's like a miracle." And I thought about first, and I explained to them how the system worked. This is a real special particularity of France, not only for actors, but in all the different jobs and skills in the performing arts. You can be a makeup artist or a stage director or someone who builds sets or all the various things. And I explained to them how the system works. And then I was thinking throughout the since, and I'm thinking how she said it's a miracle. And wondering what that meant, and also in connection with much of our conversation, of course, because the three of us being American and the two of them living there and me not living there had to do with the current cultural, political, social situation in America, but in a larger sense in the world. And I thought of this notion of something that I talk about sometimes, and it's of such importance to me that I named this sangha wildflower. The notion of wild, which is so important. And how that relates to the situation of the world today. So, vaste programme, as we could say in French. However, there are some very specific things about that can apply to our practice, our own private practice sitting on our cushions, but also how we move and act in the world at large and with others, within our families, within our job, our workplaces, within our communities, within our just being in the world, right? So this notion of wild, and some of you have heard me talk about it before, we could look at it, so tame, there's tame and there's wild. And tame would be the equivalent of a farmer's field. So it's cultivated, it's worked with, treated as, its entire existence is intended to yield a crop or to yield something. It's utilitarian and it's used to yield profit usually, because that's what a farmer needs to live is profit. And then sometimes it's taken to extremes, as we know, and we want to yield more profit and we want to yield more. And so that anything that gets in the way, any obstacle that is presented to that yielding of profit, it has to be eliminated. And we see where that takes us. And it takes us to even my mother's garage this summer, where I discovered two bottles of Roundup, which is this glyphosate product that is produced by Monsanto and is considered a great poison. And I was stunned when I found this in my mother's garage and said, "What are you doing with this?" And she said, "Oh, she lives in this gated community and they are required to have their lawns be look a certain way, and the trees have to be a certain way, and everything has to be just so. She said, I had all this, my mother's 90, right? She said, I had all this wild grass or something, weeds basically, that she had to get rid of, and she went to the garden store, and they said, oh, here, ma'am, and sold her 2 giant bottles of Roundup. She doesn't know what it is. She should, but she didn't. And so there it is in her garage. I really chewed her out. My mother, who 5 years ago had lung cancer and is not a smoker. And the doctor said to her, the cause was environmental. I don't know if she was using Roundup 5 years ago, but in any case. So we see how this permeates everything we do and think and how we function without even thinking about it. So the tame, the farmer's field, is useful, but it's limited. It's very limited. And the dangers involved with that attempt to limit are then we kill, we obstruct, we overlook, we fail to be in contact with the unlimited, the wildness of the world, if we are seeking only to limit and only to tame. And so what is the wild then? What is the wild side? The wild is far wider, deeper, complex than tame. Wild is, it can be explored. We can explore the wild, but it can never be fully known. And so if you think about this, you know, you go into the forest, I'm just using the example of what we think of as the wild in terms of plants and wildlife. We can explore it, but we can't ever fully know it. We can only experience it and relate to it in an experiential way. Because as soon as we start trying to do something else with it, we're moving into the taming aspect of it. On another level, and this relates to what my friend said about the miracle of the French system towards the arts, in our society at large, artists, writers, artists, express the wild. They are the people who are in contact with the wild, who have a deep connection with it. Of course, there are other people who do too, but this is the common role of the artist has always been that. And this is where the poetic expression is, in the wild. And it defies, the wild defies the powers that attempt to tame and control and limit and profit. And that's why they are considered dangerous. Those who express the wild are seen as dangerous.
Like homeless people.
Well, homeless people might be, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's dangerous. And so what's interesting about this miracle, as my friend said, is that for whatever reason, and we could go, you know, deeply exploring the French psyche and the French cultural development and French society and whatever, the French are somehow still in contact with that wild and the value of it. And fiercely, some people, of course, want to eliminate this system of giving money to artists. However, it has become even institutionalized, this notion of cultivating and helping keep alive the wild, having an attention to the wild. I think just personally, this is what, when my friends asked me yesterday, so why do you, I mean, I've talked to them a lot about coming to France, but I think they asked me again yesterday, so how and why did you come to France? You know? And I think, I would, of course, at the time I wouldn't have expressed it this way, but I think there was that. I think there was this importance and this attention given to the wild, which seems like a contradiction in a culture that is super, super structured, super traditional, sometimes seems so tight that there's no possibility for movement. But within that structure, there is an emphasis on cultivating the wild, even within the tightness of it. And as I look back now, from this point of view, in the way that I articulate things now, I would say that grabbed me in a way that what I had always known in the American culture, which you would think would be more attuned to the wild, but in fact is the opposite. It's very much attuned with taming. And as my friends said to me when we were talking about the political, social, cultural situation in the U.S. today, they said, one of them said that, and they are very, very pessimistic about the situation and any possibility for change. They really, although they're very active and they're really involved with a lot of other artists trying to do things and giving money to candidates because they have it, and you know, campaigning and doing a lot of things, but they're very pessimistic. And one of them said that for him, a great, maybe the culture at large, and then of course individuals, have been made crazy by, and this friend of mine is a sober alcoholic, he's been in AA for like 30 years or something, so he's very familiar with abuse and denial and all of that behavior. And he said he sees the whole situation there as people, and then individuals who have been made crazy by deep denial of genocide of the Indians, the absolute rape of the continent of the wild, you know, the attempt to tame it and yield and profit, and the whole free market thing, which is such an amazing thing to call it the free market, when in fact it's really the limiting market, and the denial of slavery. And he said his impression is that the people as a whole and the individuals have been made insane by this denial, this deep denial, and has just accepts these things as being normal. Same with guns and continuing racism and homophobia and misogynist behavior, all a result of this. I don't really know that much about denial and abuse and all that, substance abuse, so I don't really know. But something in that I heard, again, this is coming from this mentality of taming and using and profiting, of yield. Now, how does that apply to us on our, just me, you know, and just our individual lives and what we do? It can be as simple as sitting here on our cushion. So I was looking around at us today, sitting on our cushion, and it looks like an incredibly tame thing we're doing, right? It looks like we're trying to, even sometimes that language is used in meditation practices, tame the mind. And I'm always a little, when I hear that word tame, I think, what are we talking about when we're talking about tame the mind? And so we're all sitting here very tamely on our cushions, from one perspective, with very strict limits, 25 minutes, walking 10 minutes, a certain way of walking. It's not wild walking. it's not just sit wherever you want, sit however you want, do whatever you want, talk freely. There's some taming going on, right? However, we could say that that taming, I'll just use that word, that taming is coming from my own, but also yours, because you are here doing it, a deep heart desire to be free, to be wild, to tap into that wild in yourselves. We don't necessarily formulate it like that, but I'm formulating it because I'm talking about wild and tame today. Some another day I would formulate it differently, right? And if we stick just with the Zen jargon, we would say something else. If we were in another Buddhist tradition, we would say something else. But if we look at it in this perspective of tame and wild, that's what this is. And it's a deeply compassionate thing we are doing. You know, it's like when you say no to a child, stop the child from doing something that will be harmful for him or her. It's not seeking to limit the child to limit the child. It's to help the child develop healthily, is that a word? Yeah. Yes, healthily, yeah. In a healthy manner, let's say. And so it's a compassionate no. And parents sometimes have a hard time with this. Some parents more than others. There are parents who never want to say no, because they don't want to limit the child. They don't want the child to be free, and they have a difficult time saying no and whatever. But actually, there are no's that are yes. And you've heard me talk about this too, the whole yes thing. But so in this context, we're saying yes to no. So we're saying yes to not talking, to not sitting however we want, to not eating whatever we want. Because when we have our lunch, we have no idea what will be put before us. And we know what we brought, but we don't know what anyone else brought. And that's our wild lunch. It's not a planned lunch. It's planned from the point where we asked everyone to bring something. But it's not one person who did the shopping and then decides what to cook and cooks it, and then we all eat it. That too is a way of being wild, because you also don't know, in that case, what will be put in your bowl or on your plate. So we're saying yes to no in order to reconnect with that wild within ourselves. Reconnect with what is wild. And then the more we do that, the more we sit, the more we tap into that and awaken to it, as we say, we use the word awakening, the more that we can then move in the world wildly instead of tamely. It doesn't mean that suddenly you walk around with no clothes on and grow your hair and don't work and become a homeless person and beg for food. It could take that form, but chances are that would not be what is healthy for you. And in order to be truly one with the wild, you have to also be one with what is healthy, what is appropriate within the circumstances, how to do the dance with the world rather than to force the world to dance how you want to dance, something like that. And so, you know, sometimes there are crazy, wild, what we call crazy, wild artists, you know, who do wild things, we think. And they they don't behave, they don't fit well into society. Or other people who are unusual. Unusual meaning not normal, not tame. And they are often rejected or considered dangerous, like we said. And we're afraid of that. We're very fearful of that. We don't know what they will do. It's unpredictable. That's how we tend to, from the tame point of being, that's how we tend to relate to the wild. It's frightening. I know myself. I go into the forest. I'm not someone who's ever lived outside of cities, really, so I'm not familiar with it, and I find it frightening. Sometimes. It depends what it is. And I have to acknowledge that and recognize it. At the same time, I'm familiar, because I'm a poet, and I'm very familiar with the wild within myself and with all the practice I've done. I'm familiar with that. And maybe that helps me, therefore, be more comfortable in the wild out there. It could be the wild of the city, although the city is not wild in the same way that the forest is wild. But the city is wild too. It escapes all attempts to control it. Even though the city by nature is something that is being seeking to be in control. The tame aspect is always seeking for permanence, is always seeking limits, permanence, seeking to fix things. So, and we've always done, you know, human beings do this. They build walls, they build castles, they pyramids, weapons systems, you know, elaborate systems of weaponry, borders, everything seeking to make things permanent and limited. But we're not limited to that. Humans are not only that. And I thought yesterday when my friend said that, it's a miracle, I thought, yeah, you know, that's really, it seems like a miracle from the tame point of view. They just couldn't believe it. That this could be happening. But from the wild point of view, and I'm saying this as point of view, and actually it's not a point of view, but because the two function together. So that example is that a system, so a taming set of laws, and economic budgeting is devoted to cultivating the wild. So the two function together in that sense. And the wild, so the arts, contribute. It's unfathomable how the arts contribute to our lives. We can't measure it. But there is a contribution. And the French government happens to value that in a way that other governments don't. I mean, the other extreme would be, you know, the American government that eliminates the National Endowment for the Arts, eliminates the National Endowment for the Humanities, wants to do away with anything that would support artists, unless it's commercial, and then the government doesn't support it. It's businesses that support it and profit from it. So, whereas the French government doesn't really profit from this, what they're doing. They profit from it in the sense that the French cultural eminence is world-renowned. And the greater body politic, we could say, benefits from this, from the arts in France. But it's not, you can't measure it. You can't say, okay, we will invest this much and we will get this much back. In fact, I think if you could measure it, the returns would be would far exceed the investment, the returns from the arts. But it can't be measured. So, and the French government accepts not to measure it. In the ideal sense, I'm sure there are measurements that are sought, and we know that it's in jeopardy, this system. At the same time, it's a miracle that it exists in that sense. So in our own lives, already by coming and spending your Sunday sitting on your cushion in silence is already taking a step away from the tame aspect of your lives. That's why we say this is such a radical, radical practice, because it's stepping, taking a step aside or a step back from what the greater society is engaged in all the time. And of course we're engaged in it too, because we have to live, and so we have to work. We may be asked to do things that we don't really think we would like to do. You know, we might have to work on projects or work for companies that we don't really feel are in tune with what we want to do. I know working at a newspaper, there were times when I felt that what the news that was being reported was not really what I thought was important. And it took a huge, I mean, it was really, really exaggerated during the Iraq War, because the newspaper I worked for was like gung-ho behind the Iraq War, and I didn't agree with that. So there are things we have to do. Can we see it in a bigger, from the wild side, and seeing, okay, I need to do this so that I can do that, and I can try to limit what damage might be caused by any taming, I'm just using the taming thing again, the more that I cultivate the wild, the more I can see the tame, and I can see where I'm involved in it and how I'm involved in it and how I can not be so involved in it, or how I can work with it in a different way. But if we're completely involved in the tameness, we can't see the wild. The more that we become involved with the wild, the more we can see the tameness, though, and the wild. Because the tame, the world of the tame is seeking to limit. So it can't see what's beyond the tame and what serves the tame, what serves to tame. The wild, on the other hand, is inclusive of everything. But like I said, it's much deeper, wider, complex than the limited, than the tame. Any comments, questions, resonance or not, or
some resonance? Yesterday, I read an article, and this is seems to the left, but on quantum interconnectedness, and it was written by a physicist talking about how there was the wave function at a mathematical level. There's a thing called coherence and incoherence, and when two particles resonate together, they're in coherence, and it could be separated by distance of galaxies, or it could be very close. And basically he explained something I felt intuitively for a long time back in my past, that if you're in a vacuum, that resonance is measurable. Then you can, when you measure, that changes also the state of resonance, and it becomes incoherent. But everything is incoherence all the time. It's just that there's these ripples of incoherence that happen within unbelievably short periods of time, and it all gets all of the coherence remains, actually. It's just that it becomes invisible in the ripples of overlapping interactions. And that's wild. Like, that's the wildness that's completely coherent at the same time. It's completely universally sort of, at least from that mathematical perspective, it's contained and remembered in every interaction. But it's impossible to measure. It's impossible to trace. It just really clicked something in my mind that's been sort of 15 years in the process. I was like, that's exactly right, because there's this kind of traditional split in physics where they can never sort of explain how quantum interactions actually lead to the classical realm. But this is, someone's finally explained it in a way that makes sense, and that's the wildness and the tameness, really. Like, everything is completely remembered. All of those interactions are remembered in the universe. So the universe is essentially always looking at itself. And yeah, that resonated for me with the wildness and the tameness. It's like the saying, like, when a tree falls in the forest, if no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? And I've always felt like, well, of course it makes a sound, because it hears itself, and the interactions of the environment with it mean that something is always reacting to something. And so this was a great assistance to me. 15 years of pondering off and on about it.
Well, and that's where science and the arts meet as well, or science and spiritual practice meet as well, in that kind of thing. Because it resonates totally, you know? Yeah, absolutely. Well, and isn't there something in quantum physics, too, I don't know so well, about how when there is a meeting, each particle is altered by, is affected, is changed by the other, right? Something like that?
That's how the coherence passes from one particle to another, and why things can remain sort of linked to each other even though they're separated by light years. It's just that the vast interactions of the universe mean that there's all sorts of other interactions that intersperse or affect it, or change its apparent coherence. Like when you send water through two sort of archways, if they come in at the same time, they set up these standing wave patterns so that the water appears to be not moving. It's like just ripples that are constantly moving up and down in the same place, and that's a coherence. That's why when things are cohering, they're resonating and creating these patterns, and when they're incoherent, then those patterns appear to be chaos.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, what he's saying is that it's just so many interactions that they cancel each other out and so on, but it's immeasurable. Like, it's very, very hard to, you can only do it under certain conditions, create those coherence. But in fact, they're not lost. They're always there. It's just that so many other things are going on that it appears not to be there.
And that points directly to what we call interdependence in the Buddhist tradition, and the Indra's net, which is this mythical thing of a net which has the various threads are connected, each by intersecting beads, the net. And each bead reflects the other beads. And that's endlessly then, because if each bead reflects certain beads and then is reflected by other beads and resurrected, it's endless. And so there is this coherence of the beads, and yet it's beyond comprehension. You can't see the end of it. It's like what we call a mise en abîme. You know, if you have two mirrors facing each other, you know, they. Yeah. And then what would be so a concrete, practical experience of that in our lives? Does anyone have any? Of how you're interconnected or...
I can talk about wild versus tame, but it's not at the quantum level. I think it's really interesting. I completely relate to the idea that we're looking for the freedom in us, and we're looking to get beyond le devoir, beyond sort of, you know, beyond what we've been told, beyond and what we really, the freedom. And at the same time, I have a daughter who's 16, who I see myself trying to tame. And yet I don't want to tame her. I want her to reach the freedom of the wild.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing for parents, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I feel that the sometimes, I think with the practice, our practice of taming the mind is also rooted in the fact that sometimes we feel we're free when we're not. We're completely conditioned. And the taming is actually to learn to decondition ourselves. So, I mean, like, totally when we're 16 or 17 or 20 or even later, all our lives, we always have that feeling that, you know, we want to do things and all that, but we're just reacting to things. We're not really free of that conditioning. And so the taming is actually the trying to decondition in order to be free, when actually we're not.
That's the example of sitting here today, or making boundaries for a 16-year-old, giving a structure within which then the 16-year-old can learn to be free. That's what we do here too. It's the best thing we can do, actually, for ourselves and for others, is to give ourselves some structure so that we can then be free. You know, people who have no structure, they tend to be psychotic, or, if we push it really far, or have trouble then adapting to society. I'm thinking of some people I know who took their children out of school, homeschooled them, although they didn't really homeschool them, but never gave their children any kind of boundaries. And now one of the children is 30-something and doesn't work and has two children with two different fathers and was a terrific contemporary dancer, went to the conservatory, but then when she finished that, was not able to function within a company because she had never had structure and boundaries before, and so she doesn't see it that way, and this is of course my interpretation, and so therefore doesn't dance, doesn't work, is lost, could really do with some boundaries, some limits.
I don't know. That's the difficulty, is that the limits that we place on ourselves as society, we think, barring the some sort of coherence that is well beyond Earth is not, doesn't feeling right. So we want the, we really need to break through the tameness.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
it's
right.
It,
that's right. That reminds me of a story from the of this American Zen master, Isan Dorsey, who was in California, in San Francisco, and in the 50s, and yeah, in the 50s, I think, he was a drag queen.
Yes, I heard his story.
Yeah, and he, a performer in San Francisco in, like, clubs and things, drag queen, and had a lot of success. I forget what his name was. He had, like, a stage name. Tommy D, or I don't know, he had a, do you know?
I do.
Had a stage name. Anyway, and he was really popular and successful and whatever. And he started practicing Zen, I don't, can't remember why, with Suzuki Roshi, who was in the 60s, who was, you know, this one of the first Japanese masters to come to the U.S. and establish Zen practice. And he started practicing with them. And it changed his life. And he became a monk and eventually became a teacher and was a teacher at the Zen Center in the Castro District in San Francisco, which was the traditionally the gay neighborhood. And set up in the 80s a what's called the Maitri Hospice, a hospice to help to treat AIDS patients in the neighborhood in San Francisco. And eventually died of AIDS himself, but some, I'm not sure what year he died, but sometime, yeah, probably the late 90s, I don't know. In any case, there was a story, it's told kind of like a fable or like one of these koans we have that sounds, can't really be true, but he was walking down the street in San Francisco with two of his people who worked with him, who students and students, who helped him with the center and were involved with the administration and the finances of the center. And they were walking a bit ahead of him and they were discussing like what they needed to do, a fundraising project and administrative stuff to do with this hospice that they had. And he was kind of wandering behind and there was a, you know, a stray bottle someone had thrown in the street and he bent down to pick it up and he started cleaning it up to see what it was. And like happens when you rub, you know, in fairy tales, when you rub a bottle, a genie appeared. This is where it becomes kind of magic realism, right? A genie appeared. And because there were three of them, and there would be three wishes, they each got a wish. So they said to the first guy, I mean, their names were like Jerry and Bob or something. First guy, so Jerry, what do you want? And Jerry said, oh, you know, I want to be free from all of what binds me, and I want to attain absolute nirvana. And boom, he disappeared. He was gone. And says, okay, Bob, what do you want? And Bob said, I want to live in a place like Palm Springs without the desert, where unlimited, beautiful weather, swimming pools, great food, beautiful people, everything perfect, 24/7, for the rest of my life. Boom, he was gone. Off to his Palm Springs paradise, forever and ever. Then he came to Isan, who was the teacher in this situation. And Jeannie said, okay, what do you want? And he said, I want those two to come back here because we have a hospice to run. And he did. So this is kind of how we, how do we, so Isan's wish comes from his deep experience of interconnection, of oneness of all beings and things, and recognizing because you see the oneness, you see the differences, and you see, therefore you can function in the world. You can function, you know you have this hospice to run, and you know that you need money for it and administrative things for it, and there are sick people and you want to help them. You wouldn't start a hospice if you didn't see that there were sick people who needed help, right? And because he himself was a part of the gay community, he felt it probably more deeply than, you know, some guy in his skyscraper overlooking San Francisco Bay, you know, who, you know, lived in Marin County with his fancy cars and beautiful wife and children and wasn't thinking about the gay community. I'm not saying that everyone who lives in Marin County doesn't think about the gay community, but he had some connection, deeper connection with it. So it always comes from heart. So when we set any limits, if we can be connected with the wildness, that's where the heart is. Like I said the other night, was it here? Yeah. The mind creates the abyss. So the mind creates taming, creates all the separations, the differences, the coherence, and the heart, but the heart crosses that abyss. So when we connect with the wildness, that's what I said before, when we connect with the wildness, then we can better see what we need to do, how we need to establish boundaries for a 16-year-old so that the 16-year-old can also connect with the wildness. It doesn't mean that wildness means staying out until 3 in the morning and getting drunk and, I don't know, whatever 16-year-olds want to do thinking is wild, you know. That's not the wildness we're talking about. Sometimes it can be expressed that way, and 16-year-olds need to go through a lot of this stuff, you know, thinking that it's cool and wild to smoke and drink and whatever. And so as an adult, if the more that we connect with the wildness, the better we can see what's needed to help others connect with the wildness. So, you know, Isan's story, he could see what was needed in the world of the tame because he had connected with the wild as already, you know, working as a transvestite, as a drag queen in San Francisco in the 50s was pretty wild compared to the, you know, straight-laced culture that, I don't know how San Francisco was, but the rest of the country was pretty straight. So he already had experienced the wild, but then he cultivated it deeply on a different level with his Zen practice. And he no longer had to walk around as a drag queen in order to express it. He shaved his head and he became a Zen monk to express it. I don't know, maybe I don't really know his story that well. There's a book about it. Street Zen, it's called, I think.
Yeah, it was the time I remember reading this.
Street
Zen. Really
Street Zen. Yeah, and it's by David Schneider, who came here and gave a talk here last year. I don't know, a year before maybe. I don't know. Who knew him in San Francisco at the time. Anyway, that's kind of a long story, but that's how it applies. How it can apply in our daily lives. And it's you know, like I said the other night, it's a tightrope walk. You know, there's no fixed answer. There's no fixed... that we discover that the more we become in touch with the wild, the more we realize that there is no fixed answer. Nothing is stable. Everything is incoherent. At the same time, that coherence is also intrinsic. Like Gregor's saying, it's all there at once. But most of the time, we're only focusing on the coherence. And we're not paying any attention to the incoherence. We don't want to. It's frightening. It's terrifying. Incoherence. Or chaos. Bernie Glassman has, some of you have heard, you know, he started this order of disorder. Which sounds, what? An oxymoron. How can you have an order of disorder? And the basic motto of it is, don't be here now. Or, I can't remember all of them, but the four vows, the first one is, creations are numberless. I vow to count them. it's all this, it's totally absurd, but it's incredibly deep as well, you know. And the people who belong to this order of disorder, they would come to a Zen ceremony, and this actually happened. I've seen it happen, and disrupt everything. You know, there's this place in upstate New York, which is super, super orthodox Zen. Zen Mountain Monastery, run by Daido. Have you been there?
No,
you've heard
no,
of them, yeah. Daido Lori has since died, but it's still, and it's super, Daido Lori, the Zen master there, had been in the Navy, in the military, and so he, like, ran that place like a tight ship. And the rituals and things were, like, super orthodox. And when he had, like, the formal opening of it or something like that, some big event, or the 20th anniversary or something, where they had big rituals and celebrations, Daido invited Bernie, who was his older Dharma brother. And Bernie showed up in his Hawaiian shirt and his, you know, grutty jeans and his ponytail and whatever. And put on his red nose during the ceremony and disrupted the whole thing. I don't know exactly what he did, but it's a famous story. And, you know, one of the precepts too is, don't take yourself seriously. That's the basic thing of letting go. Letting go of your attachment to yourself is, don't take yourself so seriously. It's incredibly deep, the way that Bernie presents it, but it's pointing to what we always say of letting go of the self. Dogen's famous thing, to study the self is to forget the self. And to study the way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. Don't take yourself so seriously. That's one step towards forgetting the self. So don't be here now. You know, I was once in a workshop with Bernie, and he asked us, we were all teachers, and he asked us, okay, so what is for you, if you could just say one thing about your teaching, what is it? What is it? You know, so people were going around and saying whatever they think. So when it came to me, I said, be here now. Of course. Bernie and Mr. Yuhu, what's his name? Moshe Cohen, the clown, who was Bernie's teacher, just laughed and said, okay, don't, because we were trying to come up with what would be the precepts for the order of disorder. You know, so then he would take whatever we said, say the opposite became the precept. So I said, be here now. So he said, okay, good one. Don't be here now. Because as soon as you say, okay, be here now, you're fixing it. You know, you're fixing being, you're fixing here, and you're fixing now. Of course, Bernie full well knows what that means, to be here now, but he's trying to shake us out of our fixations, you know, trying to introduce us more to the wild instead of focusing on the tame. It doesn't mean rituals aren't important. Because rituals, actually, if we really respect the rituals and tap into the deep meaning of the ritual, it's the point of the ritual, kind of like this thing with the physics of, you know, making waves to go in a specific pattern, is to help us tap into the wild, what's impersonal in us. We join in this ritual and everybody does the same thing. We put aside how we want to do it, how we think we should do it, and some Zen centers are super strict and you have to start kinin on the left foot and you have to wear exactly this kind of clothing and you have to enter and leave the Zendo in a particular way, and they would not have these kind of mismatched cushions and things that we have here, and be super strict. But if we really do that ritual, it opens us up to the impersonal, which is the wild. It's like when I give this example of singing. I was once, like, in the kitchen at a Zen retreat, and I could hear, this was it in Montreuil, and I could hear upstairs the ceremony they were doing. And it was astounding, because you could hear, there were, you know, maybe 20 people there, and you could hear one person's voice. you could hear the other voices too, but one person's voice was really standing out because this person was not trying to join with the others. This person was not even thinking, I don't think, about how to sound, or they were just they were so concentrated on their own voice rather than on the communal thing. And you, as a choir director, you know this, you know what, if there's somebody singing off tune or they're not singing their part, or I don't know what the stuff is with choirs, but obviously a great choir, you don't hear just one voice, you hear the whole, and the individual voices come together to make that whole magnificent. But if it's just one voice, except if, unless it's a soloist, and then that's intended to do that. Same thing with other, other kinds of music, bands, groups, whatever. What time is it? It seems like we're going wild here.
12:35.
Okay, so that's about an hour, right? Anyways, yeah. Anything anyone would like to add before we move on to our next practice?
Maybe just one thought of something that came up. When the mind creates the abyss and the heart crosses it, the heart does not eliminate the abyss. The heart embraces the abyss and navigates through it. And I think that's, for me personally, interesting metaphor, because we can be so caught also in complaining against the limits and complaining against whatever the limits is, and then we are just stuck there, and that's not the way.
Exactly. Instead of working with the limits,
yeah,
working with it,
embracing them,
embracing it, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. The heart does not close the abyss. It crosses it. Yeah.
Moves freely through it.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. We'll stop there.